Monday, January 20th. I was up early, like when I was a child, and it was the day to go to the country fair, and I didn't want to miss a thing. Coffee at 7, a small private smile to the big canopied bed that I would not sleep in again, and to the courteous, deferential White House butler who brought the tray. I'm glad I spent a lot of Saturday afternoon saying goodbye, because I do not remember that I said many goodbyes to the staff on Monday. And Mr. Pear in to comb my hair before 8. And then in my robe with a cup of coffee in my hand, a last little pilgrimage of my own into all the rooms on the second floor, walking around quietly, partly to see if there was any personal object left anywhere, mostly just to stand still and absorb the feel of the yellow room and the tree room. I shall never forget it. The Lincoln room. And the little Lincoln sitting room. And here I found a whole coffee table full of dirty dishes, which I quickly reported to John, some of the guests from last night's party, in search of chairs and a place to perch their plates, had drifted in here. Mm-hmm. He sounded as though he was going to search even the most remote corners anyway, and ask him to please take down the portraits of Lyndon and me, still on the easels in the East Hall, mm-hmm. and put them in the care of the curator, and into the Queen's sitting room, and then into the lovely Queen's room. Here and in the red room and in the green room, I like the flower arrangements most of all, I believe. About 9:30, I went up to Ashton's office, one of the last in the whole White House to be dismantled or to stop functioning. It was a pandemonium, knee-deep in boxes and pieces of paper. She said she would have it all clean by a little past 11 to make a final walk-through and be out by noon. And then into Lucy's room, which looked hopeless. Scattered bags half opened, dispatching Patrick and Olga and Miss Glazel and Lucinda out to the Cliffords at about the time we left, maybe 5 minutes before or 5 minutes after. Thank heavens, with 1 hour left of the Secret Service, I don't have to handle that. Lucy, in her willful, highly feminine way, had decided to wear what she thought was her prettiest outfit, a very heavy black and yellow dress, for which she had no just-right coat, and kept on assuring me no, she wouldn't be cold during the ceremony. And then, into the pineapple bedroom, where I found a guest book of the myriad guests who had stayed upstairs with us, and put it back in Ashton's hands, and through the rest of the guest rooms, and into the solarium, its personality all stripped away, and looking cold and clinical now. And what a gay room it's been, with Lucy's signature face on the window, and poo pictures, and trip pictures, and stacks of records, and off on a buffet table for the stream of house guests. I went back down to my room and put on the peach pink dress that I would wear, and then down to the red room. The floor was alive with butlers and cleaning people, and there was a smell of ammonia in the air. What a surprising household smell here. John assured me it would be gone in 30 minutes. And yes, he would light the fires, and we would have some sweet rolls with the coffee. A couple of times, I went into Lyndon's room. He'd been on the phone constantly since 7 o'clock, or talking with aides, dictating, dispatching Jim or Larry with some last thing to be done. Once he showed me a couple of sheets of paper, the citations for Mary Lasker and Lawrence Rockefeller. He was giving them the Medal of Freedom, and these were the brief records of their accomplishments for their countrymen. It was a list, about 20 long, that we had discussed over a period of months. I was glad he was doing it, but wished he had done it a month ago with pomp and ceremony. It was very hard for him to choose some and exclude others. I made a few changes in Mary's and Lawrence's. After a while, it was time to put on my elegant mink hat. What an indulgence! How often will I wear it at Stonewall? Pick up my muff, tell Lyndon I would be a few minutes early, and to come as soon as he could, and down I went to the red room. For me, in any day of crisis, all the real emotions, all the leave-takings, or whatever it is, have already been lived through at a quieter time. And from now on, one is sort of anesthetized in armor, and still the feeling of going to the fair and wanting to absorb, take in everything was with me, but not to feel it. The day blurs into a montage, and I am not sure of sequence, I think Leonard was there all the time, and from our viewpoint, the orchestra master, and I believe Hubert and Muriel were the first to come. And then, as it so often happened, we got the message, they're 2 minutes away, and Lyndon and I walked out on the north portico, lined heavily on both sides with cameramen. And there on the left was an hilarious sight. Mr. Trafees Bryant, at his feet, a bouncing Yuki, freshly washed and wearing a bright coat that Mrs. Bryant had made, and a darling gray poodle, clipped and brushed and proud, and tucked into Mr. Bryant's coat, a little miniature of a dog, breed unknown, surveying this scene with bright, alert eyes until the human members of this drama arrived. These characters had been filling in for the cameraman. The big black car rolled up, and out stepped the president-elect, growing momently more impressive somehow, and Mrs. Pat, in a smashing rosy red outfit, belted with lapels and a fur hat, pretty little Tricia stepped from somewhere in a powder blue coat with little touches of fur. She's tiny and very feminine. And Julie, taller, darker, and more vivacious than lanky, smiling young David. We stopped on the portico for pictures, right and then left, and then the funny little business that so often happens about who goes in the door first, until I took Pat's arm firmly and said, "Shall we go in?" And then we were all in the red room, the crowd enlarging to include Senator Dirksen and Speaker McCormick and the Vice President-elect and Mrs. Agnew and their son, who'd been in Vietnam with his wife, and their two daughters, Senator Mansfield and Gerald Ford, Senator Jordan and Carl Albert, and Linda and Lucy, who gravitated once to the young Nixon. I noticed Lucy and Tricia in animated conversation in a corner, apparently getting along very well. And Linda asking David if he really did leave all those notes behind the pictures. And I asking Mr. Marriott how he was managing with his thousands of friends who must suddenly have come from the far reaches of the United States, demanding a suite with a large living room. Over in the corner, I saw Liz and Beth standing together, surveying the scene. How wonderful it's been to work with them all these years. And then there was Leonard Marks saying, "It's time to get into the cars." And Pat and I and Speaker McCormick went out together and took our places in a car. Lyndon and Mr. Nixon were in the lead car and in between some Secret Service. And somewhere behind, Linda and Lucy and Leonard Marks, we all laughed that they were going to have the merriest time of anybody. It took a while before everyone got in, and I looked up at the facade of the White House. And there, glued to one of the windows, were the faces of John Ficklin and German, and another butler, was it Johnny? And that was my last view as I drove away from the White House, and we started the parade down Pennsylvania Avenue. It was strange. There were very few people. A little knot here, a group there. I waved busily and tried to lock eyes whenever I saw an animated face, but mostly they just stood, and I did not see a familiar face the whole length of Pennsylvania Avenue. But there were a good deal of banners and bunting. Our conversation was desultory and trivial. We were glad it wasn't sleeting. We might even avoid rain, although it was a gray, brooding day. And I said I felt sure the stands were going to be full by the time they rode back. Somehow, I felt vaguely sorry that they weren't. And every now and then, a booming remark of substance from the speaker, all the more surprising, coming from that frail, desiccated man, saw a few children with flags. And he said, from deep within the well of his thoughts, "I like to see them with flags." And we both looked at the Capitol, he and I. And I told about how, driving in from Virginia on summer afternoons, the other speaker, Mr. Sam Rabin, used to say, "How do you like my Capitol?" And we said together something like, "We all feel that it's ours." And then, as we drove up under the porte-cochere at that great old building, we were met and escorted, with minimum confusion, to the office of Senator Margaret Chase Smith. And there was Mrs. Eisenhower, in a dark dress with an awful face hat, but as poised and friendly and lively as in all the more vigorous years that I'd known her. I was glad to see her, and I had one brief minute with her to tell her how much I had always appreciated her coming to the Senate ladies' luncheons in my time in the White House. And she, in turn, recalled how nice it had been that Mrs. Woodrow Wilson had come to earlier functions in her day. Lyndon and Mr. Nixon went to some adjoining office, and presently some orchestrator of all this drama gave us a signal, and together, Muriel and I walked out the door and down the great steps of the Capitol under the commanding, handsome, newly built portico, face to face with the great sea of faces that stretched off to the right to the House office buildings and to the left to the Senate office building and in front of us over toward the Supreme Court, side by side, and it gave me a warm pleasure that we walked together. Later, Muriel said the same, and we took our seats on the front row and then turned our heads to watch the next entrant onto the stage of this great quadrennial American pageant. Try as I did to soak everything up, I cannot remember for sure. I think that when Lyndon walked in, they played Hail to the Chief, and this time, truly the last time, he looked very tall and handsome and impressive, and very relaxed, too, I thought. And then I think Mrs. Nixon came in alone, the bright rose red, a smashing success, and finally, the country's new president. For all the preparation that went into it, it was a brief ceremony, only about 45 minutes, I believe. And how to describe it? Low-key, restrained it was to me. None of the youthful ebullience, the poetic brilliance of the Kennedy inauguration, or the warm, roaring, Jacksonian quality of ours. I remember only bits and pieces, a special smile between me and Mrs. Warren. She was right behind us. Among the five prayers, one was by the head of the Greek Orthodox Church, who had been my companion on our trip to the funeral of the King of Greece, along with President Truman. Looking out onto the sea of faces and finding so few familiar ones, Alan Drury, I believe, and a very personal, warm smile from some of the newspaper women down front, for Hilla LaHaye, Betty Beale. A murmured remark now and then to Mrs. Agnew, who was on my left, something like, "It's going to be so much that you'll enjoy," or, "We wish you good luck in all the years ahead." And there, towering in front of us, was the newsstand. It seems to get bigger every year, the great eye of television trained down on us. And I remember the corresponding appreciation and dismay that when there was a prayer, the orchestra broke forth in the Star Spangled Banner. In one of the booths, one of the commentators rose to his feet, unselfconscious, natural. And in the other booth, the other commentators sat sprawled around their tables, perhaps handling their instruments required this. And then an odd optical illusion during the swearing-in of Vice President Agnew. Hubert was standing directly behind him. And as Agnew raised his hand, and I looked at the tableau, it looked as though it was Hubert's hand that was up. And then the inaugural speech itself. The paper said it was 17 minutes long, and he delivered it rather quickly in an even voice. It was, I thought, low-key, with much accent on peace. There were no high trumpet calls to action, and probably that is just as well. God knows there's been plenty of striving in the last 8 years, and probably the country is tired of striving. Maybe we just want to hold still and absorb the deluges of change for a while. It was interrupted by brief applause from time to time. There was no great surge of emotion that swept the sea of people in front of us. And then, well before one, he finished, and we all rose to take our departure. I said goodbye to pretty little Tricia on my right next to Muriel, in case I did not really get to make a formal goodbye to Pat of the new president, and as it happened, I didn't really. And then I was swallowed up in the great departing throng going up the stairs, trying to take in every face that I saw, so many of them unfamiliar. His cabinet right behind President Nixon, and over beyond off the stand, a group of senators, and then up the stairs themselves, on one side, the diplomatic corps, a last big smile to Sevilla Sacasa, and at the top of them, Hugh O'Brien, who was, I think, in charge of their gala. And then we were in the big black car down below, Lyndon and I, and Linda and Lucy, and driving with a motorcycle escort away from the Capitol grounds and down through the streets, now more filled with people, and out onto the George Washington Parkway and toward the Cliffords. I was propped for some newspaper coverage outside, but not for what we found. It looked like we had moved backwards in time to some particularly homey campaign rally. Their quiet front lawn, secluded from the highway by a hedge, was jam-packed with people. Little boys up the apple tree, babies in arms, high school and college youngsters carrying signs. We'll never forget you, LBJ. You did a good job. We still love you, Lyndon. Somebody had a Texas flag, and it was a great big U.S. flag waving precariously in front of us across the sidewalk. Marnie, without a coat, and Clark were standing at the end of the sidewalk to greet us. We hugged them and made our way up the sidewalk, shaking hands to right and left, trying to think of a courteous brief phrase for the microphones that were stuck in front of us, and finally, pausing on the front stoop for our picture with the Cliffords, we quite lost Lucy in the crowd, because, of course, her Secret Service departed at the stroke of 12, but I really think she was reveling in it as much as having difficulty. Inside that warm and welcoming house, there awaited us one of the most significant and dear parties I shall ever attend. A good part of the cabinet, but not all. I hoped we had finished, done with the need for categories. There were the Rusk and the Fowlers and the Freemans and the Allen Boyds and C.R. Smith and the Marvin Watsons. And from Lyndon's staff, Walt Rostow and the George Christians. And from mine, Liz and Bess and their husbands. Hubert and Muriel, of course. And from the house, the Hale Boggs and Jake and Beryl Pickle. In all the 60-odd people, there was only one regret, George Mahon's. And that, late in the day, because they had been asked to represent the state of Texas in some of the inaugural festivities. There were four senators there, the Mike Munroneys, and the Birch Byes, and the Scoop Jacksons, and the Gail McGees. Out-of-towners, Arthur Krim, and Jane and Charles Engelhard, who were asking about our plans to come to Florida, and just one press person, the Bill Whites, and one from the court, Abe and Carol Forrest, and from elsewhere in the government, the Leonard Marks, the Bill Deason, and Averill Harriman. Only one thing marred my sheer delight in the day, and that is, we must leave, not later than 3, in order to get to Austin, before the inaugural proceedings there got underway. We did not want to conflict or upstage. I own State of Texas inaugural, and a lot of the good Democrats and officials wanted to come out to the airport to meet us. And so time was our tyrant. One of the blessings of the future might be that this tyrant will fade into the wings. I remember vignette. I sat in one of Marnie's small, delightful groupings with Marvella By and Lindy and Mary Ellen, and we talked about our trip down the Mississippi. There, right outside the open window, about 8 feet away, was the whole yard full of people, the little boys up the apple tree, and a young man with a sign that said, LBJ in 72. I smiled and waved, and then he turned it around, and it said, Lynn in 2004. And then once when I went upstairs, there was Linda standing in a window, holding Lucinda in her arms and waving down at the crowd below and pointing out the signs to Lucinda and all the crowd waving back. And then there was a moment when I got a rather imperious request to come upstairs at once. I think it was from Jim Jones. Lyndon wanted me up there, and I saw him gathering up others who converged in Clark and Marnie's bedroom. Them and Averill Harriman and Bill White and Lyndon. And Lyndon told us what it was about. Early this morning, he had conferred the Medal of Freedom on Clark and Harriman and Bill White and 17 others. He read Clark's citation and Harriman's and gave them to them. Bill's would be sent to him later. And then he talked of the others, much of Rusk, who had already been awarded it earlier with distinction, and of Walt Rostow and his selfless service to his country and his president. In an incredibly tough spot, I think I saw tears in Marnie's eyes. What Lyndon said was a personal, intimate talk in a low voice, very earnest, no speech at all. I was enormously gratified. I had wanted him to do this, but earlier, with pomp and fanfare. But I was glad that at last it was done. Bill White answered, and this tough and seasoned man seemed close to tears. He described his feeling for Lyndon briefly, just about 4 words. One of them was gallant. who has a very felicitous way with words, and this unplanned little talk was good enough to be graven in stone. The hands of the clock prodded us on. I went down and led off the group in loading our plates at a sumptuous, beautiful luncheon table. Promotion in times of great significance do not spoil my appetite. Rather, they seem to fuel it. I divided my precious moments between the delicious food and enjoying the guests, every one of whom meant so much to me, and remembering to smile and wave from time to time to our audience in the yard who was still watching through the windows. Lucinda made an appearance now and then in her little yellow infant seat, regarding us all with solemn big eyes and occasionally a toothless granny grin. And Patrick Linden was weaving his way through legs while Lucy Auger or I retrieved Marnie's little treasure from the low tables at his approach. And then, too quickly, I got the signal, time to go, let's go to the cars. I hugged Marnie and Clark, not expecting to see them again, although they insisted they were going to race us to Andrews. We stopped on the front porch briefly again, and Lyndon said a few words into Ray Shearer's microphone, how he had been a part of Washington for more than 30 years and loved it, and we would come back to visit, and with waves and handshakes and calls of God bless you, Mr. President, we'll miss you, Lyndon, we made our way through the car, the four of us together, and headed for the helicopter on the grounds of the Bethesda Naval Center. Only en route did I remember that I had left my elegant fur muff and my brand new gloves sufficient most of these years, and here at the last moment I fall apart. When I reached the helicopter, my farewell to one of my Secret Service agents, whom I would see no more, I think it was Woody Taylor, was to round up these two possessions as a parting kind gesture to me and send them along. There was a small crowd, even at the helicopter. We flew in silence over Washington and landed at Andrews. And there was a big crowd, lining the fence and drawn up around Air Force One. Lyndon strode past the lined up military and began to shake hands at the fence. The band played Ruffles and Flourishes, but not Hail to the Chief, an Auld Lang Syne and Yellow Rose of Texas, and there was a salute of guns, I think 21, and it was total confusion and dear and wonderful. Lucy was crying, more a total living of the day than sadness, I think, and saying of Lynn, he's just lost 21 of his best friends, meaning the Secret Service. In the crowd, I glimpsed Sharon with her little son, and Cynthia, and the Wilbur Cohens, and above the heads, Ramsey Clark, and do I ascribe to his face a touch of sadness, or is it there? And there was Diana, and I was still clutching in my hand the darling little nosegay she had sent to the Cliffords for me, and the speaker. At this, I was very deeply touched. And of course, Congressman Jake Pickle, and a strong Republican Congressman, George Bush. And this touched me also. And the attractive young Catos, who are up for the inaugural festivities, of course. And Ashton in tears. And to my amazement, standing at the foot of the steps were none other than Clark and Marnie, and Dean and Virginia, who had indeed raced us and had gotten there, and quite a group of the people who had been at lunch. We mounted the steps of Air Force One, Lyndon carrying his faithful companion, Lynn, stopped at the top, the family, and turned and waved in a conscious goodbye tableau, eyes searching for the eyes of the most dear and most familiar. And there, close to the foot of the steps, stood Liz with a sign that was an invitation to laughter. Culpepper, thank you. Shades of 1960. It was a quiet flight down. One of the first things I saw was a big bunch of yellow roses with a card on it from the Nixons. What a thoughtful thing to do. And I felt a salute, too, to their efficiency, knowing something of how great the demands on them and all their staff were today. I tried to sleep, couldn't, read the accounts of the things that I had lived through. And about 5:30, we arrived at Bergstrom. Here, indeed, was a crowd, perhaps 5,000, packed along the fence and a receiving party at the foot of the steps of the plane. Tall Ben Barnes in his tux, only moments away from one of his own inaugural parties. What a nice thing for him to do. And Eloise and Homer, and Chancellor Ransom and Hazel, and Mayor Aiken and his wife, who presented me with a beautiful bouquet. All the first flowers of spring, iris, tulips, narcissus, violets, specially prepared by Marietta Brooks, she said. And Bob Strauss and Carolyn Kellum with both our little children, and the Deets, of course. The Longhorn Band was there in bright orange, and they played Ruffles and Flourishes, and then the Eyes of Texas, with a big sign above the base operations that said, "Welcome home, Mr. President and family." Lyndon made a brief speech, ending with the hope that the country would be as understanding with Nixon as it had been with him, and knowing him and his deep respect for the office of the presidency, I didn't think he meant it as irony. And he ended up saying, "Whether we are Democrats or Republicans, Texans or New Yorkers, we love our country, or we ought to love it." And then once more he took to the fence with the wind blowing him in the face, grabbing for hands with both of his, and finally picking up Lynn and taking him along the fence, while Linda with Lucinda in her arms and I followed, smiling and waving. And then with a last goodbye to an airport fence, and also goodbye to Lucy and Lynn, who were going to their house, Lyndon and Linda and Lucinda and I got on the Jet Star and headed for the ranch. I looked over my shoulder, and there was a silver crescent of a new moon, bright and clear and full of promise. It reminded me of the astronauts, and it reminded me, rather preciously, of a line in one of Lyndon's recent speeches about quoting one of the astronauts who said that he would look at the moon in years to come and remember with wonder that he was there. And both Lyndon and I will look back at the presidency with wonder that we were there. But there was still one more reception committee, and it turned out to be quite a lively one. We got to the ranch just as dark was falling. There, around the hangar, were about 500 local folks, not A.W. and Melvin and the big Heffies of the area, but the Malacheks and innumerable Weinheimers, Father Schneider and the Truesdales. Lyndon invited everybody into the hangar, and then he made them a rather long and pretty fulsome talk about how glad he was to be home, called Paul to get him some little gold pins, and then stood at the door as he shook hands with everybody and said goodnight and handed them one of the little souvenir pins. Linda with Lucinda and I went on into the living room. There were Arthur and Matilda. Dale joined us, and Mrs. Truesdale. We relaxed with a drink, and then we had dinner with Mary Rather and Juanita and Yolanda. At a little past nine, I went to bed. The line of poetry ringing in my mind, I think it's from India's love lyrics. "I celebrate my glad release, the tents of silence and the camp of peace." And yet for me, it's not quite the exit line, because I have loved almost every day of these 5 years. A better go to sleep line was one of the signs I had seen today, my favorite. LBJ, you were good for the USA.